to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 5th of July, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another glorious week in Blighty, and who better to start the week with than myself and my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How you doing? It's a little bit close where I am here at the moment. It's a little bit damp in the air. What's it like where you are?
Well, the weather's slightly overcast, but still warm enough. I've been out enjoying myself in the sunshine, and the sunshine that we had yesterday, actually, because we had a bit of sunshine yesterday, and I went out on a long bike ride there, which got me my normal week's exercise. But there's some interesting stories starting to bubble up to the surface that we can talk about, and I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, so we've got quite a few news stories to get into this week. I missed all the news last week. I had guests with me. I had a very nice time getting out and about in beautiful Wales. It is such a beautiful countryside. It is such a shame, though, that we have all these horrible statues that are popping up all over the place. And we either have decent statues that are being pulled down of philanthropists and our great heroes of the past, or we have horrible monstrosities that are being put up in their place. And the latest monstrosity is a statue of Diana. And it's a very strange statue of Diana. And the first picture that I saw of it had Prince Harry and Prince William, and they were looking at it. And I looked at this statue and I thought, well, hang on a minute. This shows a little boy and a little girl. They've turned Harry into a little girl. And then I looked a little bit closer at another view of the statue, and in actual fact, there's a little black boy there as well. So it's basically showing Lady Diana with a black child and a boy and a girl. So maybe Harry's turned transsexual. And then I looked a little bit further into it, and I thought, well, what are they trying to show here? They're just trying to be politically correct and not show the princes? Are they trying to show her as being this great motherly figure? I don't think she was ever seen as a great motherly figure. She divorced her husband, which I don't think is a very good thing for a mother to do. But a lot of people are complaining about this in the press, and I know that you've been looking into this, and you know a little bit about the sculpting of statues anyway, Max. So what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I thought it was quite a strange statue, and just like you, yes, I was surprised at the children that are around her. There are actually three children. There's a just behind her, there's another boy as well. So there's a white boy, you know, what looks like a white girl, and then there's this sort of black boy that's at the front there, which I think is intended to try and show Diana as a kind of great white mother figure. Because H. Millard, if you ever read any of H. Millard's writings, and I highly recommend them, because H. Millard is a brilliant writer. He talks about a concept which he calls the great white father and the great white mother complex that certain people get, where they turn their backs on the children of their own nation and focus all their attention on the children of Africa and the children of Asia, and make it their life's work to devote as much of their time and money and promotion to promoting the interests of children in the third world, and completely ignore the any hardships that are faced by the children of their own nation back here. And the reason being that when they go out to Africa, they're lauded as if they are, you know, kings and queens and almost godlike figures. And it's the kind of vanity stroking and the flattery that comes from being a great white mother. And it's fairly evident that it appears to me in any event that that's kind of like the way that William and Harry see their mother, not just as their mother, but as a great white mother to the children of the world.
They're sort of lionizing it then, aren't they? They're lionizing this image of this woman with somebody else's children rather than her own children there. And not just somebody else's children, but somebody else's children from another race. Or else it's saying that it's lionizing a woman who has two husbands, two different fathers of her children, and it's lionizing that and glorifying it and saying what a great thing it is. I mean, I would be pretty upset if I saw my mother depicted in that sort of a way, as if she'd, put it about and had different fathers of her children. I think it's pretty disgraceful. But sorry for interrupting you there. Go on, Max.
It's okay. But the other thing that struck me was that the statue wasn't a very good likeness in my view. And one of the things that I noticed was that if you look at Harry and William when they're standing in front of the statue and you look at how tall they are relative to the height of their head, I can't remember off the top of my head what the proportions are now, but that there was so many heads sort of go into the height of a statue from the feet up to the shoulder. But the if you look at the statue of Diana, her head looks slightly larger in proportion to the rest of her body than their heads look in proportion to their bodies, which makes it slightly strange. But then also I noticed that the facial features looked strangely masculine. And I noticed in the news over the weekend that certain commentators had likened the statue to Sean Bean. They said that Diana looked like Sean Bean, and I think that's going that's a bit too unkind to the artist that's produced the statue. But I do think that the statue is more masculine looking, and to me looks like a sort of, it looks like George Hamilton, the American actor, George Hamilton, perhaps in drag. Because I think the shoulders have been made slightly too broad as well, and that's then made her breasts look larger than they otherwise would be, which gives a slightly sort of drag queen aspect to the statue, in my view. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and obviously the sculptor who made the statue felt that the proportions were right. But one of the things that I've noticed myself from artwork that I've done myself is that it's very difficult to capture a woman's likeness in stone or in bronze or even in clay. And that's because part of what makes somebody look like what they do is the life essence within them. And when the life essence isn't within them, they look different. And this is the difference between a living person and a corpse once the person's died. If you've ever seen somebody after they've died, they always look slightly different to the way they looked when they were alive. And the difference is the fact that the life essence has drained out of them. And when you try to make a statue of somebody, if you try to make the statue exact, if you try to make it photo real, then what happens is that it's very difficult to translate, they're very difficult to try and create the life essence in that statue, because basically the statue is made of stone or it's made of bronze. It's not made of human flesh with life and blood pulsing through it. And in my opinion, it's necessary to make a statue looks very, very slightly caricatured, not to the extent that it looks like a caricature, but you just have to exaggerate certain of the features, like the size of the eyes and things of this sort, in order to fake the life essence within the statue that then makes the statue a good likeness, because when people look at it, they see the person that they love together with the life essence or the faked life essence. Whereas if you make the statue photo real, then you miss the life essence and the statue doesn't have quite the same likeness. And so I think it's a bit of a shame, really, that the statue's not turned out to be quite as nice a statue as it otherwise would be. But obviously the brothers appear to be, William and Harry appear to be very pleased with it. And so I suppose it served the purpose that they wanted for it. I think the garden that it's set in, though, is a beautiful garden, and whoever did the work there in terms of choosing the plants and creating that setting did a wonderful job. And so the landscape gardeners, etc., at Kensington Palace are to be congratulated for the work they did there.
Well, and you were telling me that the artist himself is responsible for the pictures of the three soldiers that are at the war memorial in France, and that's a very good sculpture. I mean, I was very impressed with that.
That's right. We were saying how good that was when we spoke about that a few weeks back. But I suppose it's the difference, as I say, it's the difference between making a statue photo real or making it ever so slightly caricatured in order to capture or in order to fake the life essence.
And I mean, I've seen some really amazing statues, marble ones, where the person is sort of covered in a sheet, and it's just incredibly lifelike. And I guess it must be the accentuation of certain features, as you were saying there. Perhaps he gave Lady Diana too much of a square chin, or something like that, which is, you know, the sort of thing that you associate with males. But we've also got other statues that are in the news, and these are statues of Queen Elizabeth and Queen Victoria, which have been pulled down. They've been lynched in Canada, and obviously that's not a part of British news because it didn't take part in Britain, but it's our British royalty that have been attacked here, and the reason for attacking it is so bizarre. The Canadians are upset because a graveyard has been found at one of the Catholic schools, and it's a very old graveyard. It must go back about 150 years at the sort of time when people were dying of diseases, and nobody knew what it was that was actually killing these people. And the Catholics had very kindly been trying to integrate these native peoples into civilization. And there's been all these complaints that that they weren't allowed to speak their native Indian language. How terrible that was. Well, the Welsh weren't allowed to speak Welsh up until about 50 years ago. I know people that were not allowed to speak Welsh in their school lessons. And they don't go pulling down statues. And yet what's happened in Canada is they've now found this graveyard, and they've said, well, this must be a genocide. They must have all been deliberately killed. It's quite obvious the Catholic Church is not going to go out massacring school children. They must have died of some kind of disease, some kind of plague, something like that. But the response has been to destroy the statues of the head of the Church of England. Nothing to do with the Catholic Church. What has Queen Victoria or Queen Elizabeth got to do with the Catholic Church or the Catholic Church schools in Canada? Absolutely nothing. I think this really clearly shows that these attacks on these statues, it's not about helping the natives. It's not about standing up for Black Lives Matter. It's just about finding any excuse possible to attack representations of white people. And we know that this is going to escalate to attacks on white people themselves. These people, they cannot stand to actually see representations of us in statue form. Quite clearly, they're not going to be very happy about seeing us in the flesh. And it's a very dangerous situation. But this is absolutely ludicrous that they have pulled these statues down with no link whatsoever to these schools. But to be attacking the schools anyway is wrong. Just because you find a graveyard somewhere doesn't mean that all the people there were deliberately murdered by the people in the schools. And I was very sad to see that RT were implying that. They were implying that this was a genocide and that these pupils must have been killed by the school teachers, because why else would you have a graveyard there at a school? I mean, it just seems obvious to me that they've died from disease, and they didn't know about viruses back then. They didn't know that these viruses caused these diseases. They were very worried about the fact that these Indians were dying of these diseases that the white people weren't. And they didn't realize that they were transferring germs to them, that they didn't have an immunity system to the sort of things that we have an immune system today. Things like the common cold could have killed them. They just didn't know that at the time. It's ludicrous to hold people responsible for it today. Trudeau is even demanding that the Pope apologize for this. And yet the Catholic Church was trying to help these people. A good deed never goes unpunished, does it, Max?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right in all this. In the village where I live, there's a lovely church, and in the church there is, next door to it, there is a graveyard. And when I first came to this village, I discovered that graveyard. Well, I wasn't the first person to discover it, because all the people in the village knew about the graveyard as well. But I discovered it myself for the first time, and my first thoughts weren't, oh, this must be a scene of genocide. My first thoughts were, oh, here are the graves of people who've lived in this place over hundreds of years and who have died. And my natural assumption was that the vast majority of them would have died of natural causes, because murders and etc. in this country were very, very rare until the time of mass immigration into this country. And if you look at these the figures that have been thrown up for these two schools, you know, it's been stated in the news that 150,000 children went through these schools and were discouraged from learning their own native language and were encouraged to learn to speak English or French. And the reason why they were encouraged to speak English and French is so that they wouldn't be handicapped, so that they wouldn't be speaking English and French as a second language, as a minority group in a country where English and French were the two official languages, primarily English. And so the attempt on the part of the Catholic Church was to help these children to enable them to become more successful. And that wouldn't have been done had they been encouraged to remain separate from the rest of Canadian society and to continue to speak their own native language. But the point is that in both of these, because there were two schools involved in this, one in a place called Maryvale and the other one in a place called Kamloops, Maryvale being in Saskatchewan and Kamloops being in British Columbia. At the Maryvale school, there were 750 graves found, and there were 215 at Kamloops. But the point is that these schools existed from the early 1800s through to around about the mid 1900s, and they existed over a period of 150 years, and there were, as we've I've already stated, there were approximately 150,000 children that went through them, out of which a total of 965 apparently died and were buried in these unmarked graves. Well, 965 is less than 1% of that 150,000. It's 0.64%. So it's a tiny, tiny number when you compare it with the number of children that went through the school. But then what happened during the period that the children were at this school? Because everybody knows now about COVID-19 virus that swept the world. And has caused now millions of people to die. And everybody, as a result of discussion of COVID-19, is aware of the Spanish flu that swept the world in 1918. And something like 300 million people died from that flu. But there also was another flu pandemic that was similarly deadly, that swept the world only about sort of 30 years earlier than that, in the late 1900s, about 1890. I think it was called the Russian or Chinese flu or something of that sort, but it was another flu that swept. And so in these schools where they had children obviously living in kind of dormitory arrangements, which is the sort of thing that happened in residential schools during those sort of times, had those flu epidemics reached the schools, which they did, because there were records in Kamloops, at least, that I've read about, where it was reported that the Spanish flu had a devastating effect in Kamloops. Then I think it's fairly evident that probably what happened in this case is that these children were the very unfortunate victims of the Spanish flu, or the earlier flu that swept through the area, to which there was no antidote, there were no vaccines that could be taken in those days. And these were viruses that didn't just kill children of native Indian extraction. They killed children, the children of the white settlers that settled in Canada as well. And so there almost certainly wasn't anything racial about the fact that these children died. It is just a matter, a very unfortunate fact, that they were in a school and were therefore living in close proximity to themselves. The school then would have been under great pressure to bury the bodies as quickly as possible in order to prevent the spread, in the same way that the people of India today are rushing the bodies down to the sides of the River Ganges so that they can burn them there before they infect anybody else. And in the same way, people would have buried these children very quickly in unmarked graves in order to prevent the further spread of those viruses. So this is a story where the critical race theorists that exist, who basically are people who want to bring about the extinction of the white race, and who spew out daily hatred about white people, have looked at this evidence that they found. And instead of making the natural assumption that these were people who must have unfortunately died of natural causes, they've decided that because they were children of Indian extraction or American Indian extraction, and that they were under the tutelage of people who were trying to teach them English, that it must have been a genocide, which is obviously defamatory to white people. And I would say that where people automatically jump to these kind of assumptions in order to try and place white people in a position of hatred, where they try to vilify white people without there being full evidence, that is evidence really of racial hatred towards white people. And so the people that spew out this baseless nonsense should be prosecuted for incitement to racial hatred.
Well, it's quite clear that that's the intent that's behind it, because there's no evidence to back up their claims. I mean, all you have to do is look at the infant mortality rate of some of the greatest Britons that we look at. Blatchford with his children that died when they were young. And we've had others that had children when they died when they were young. Lots of children, white children in Britain were dying at that time in the working classes. It's not something that was unique to these Indians. And the fact that they were trying to integrate them into the civilization and get them to speak French or English, that was so that they could take part. It was so that they weren't excluded. I mean, we have people that try to break into our countries today. They're so desperate to get into our civilization. And what you had there in Canada was they were helping these people to come into our civilization, teaching them and integrating them and trying to do their best for them instead of just keeping them out in an apartheid system. And they're not thanked for it in any way. And I just have to credit Andrew Anglin for pointing out that people say, well, we had these terrible Indian wars, but look at the way that the Indians are now. We also had wars against Germany. We also had wars against Japan. And look at how Germany and Japan are now. You can't say that because we went to war against the Indians, that's the reason why they're in the situation that they are in now. That they are a different people. They have a lower IQ. They have a propensity for alcohol. They have a propensity for gambling. I mean, if you look at the Aborigines in Australia, they have a propensity for huffing on gasoline. I mean, there are negative aspects to these other races, and it's something to do with them. Everybody just wants to blame white people for everything, and this is a ridiculous example of it. When you find a graveyard and you automatically assume it must be a genocide, and the fact that they're unmarked graves, I mean, did they have names? I mean, I'm not even sure that we as white people had names until fairly recently. We know that even the soldiers that fought with the British Army at the turn of last century, they were buried in unmarked graves because they had no tradition of burial or honouring their dead or putting up memorials to their dead. They may not have even had separate names. And so that they were buried in unmarked graves, and that was just the way that it was done. And that was done for the people that were willing to lay down their lives for our country fighting in our army. I mean, so we must have respected them. We must have had respect for them. So the fact that these children were in unmarked graves, it doesn't show that the Catholics didn't have respect for these children. They quite clearly did. They quite clearly had a lot of concern for them, or they wouldn't have been looking after them in the way that they are. And I mean, all you have to do is look at the amount of people that are trying to break into our country today to understand that those Indians back then, they wanted a part of civilization, and the Catholics were trying to help them. And talking of people trying to break into our civilization, we still have all these illegal immigrants, these fake asylum seekers that are coming over in their boats, and the Lifeboat Association is involved in it as well, I hear, Max, going all the way up to 2 miles off France to pick them up. Is that right?
Well, there was a report by Sue Reed, who is a journalist for the Daily Mail, and she has been studying what's been going on with regard to Border Force just recently. And she published an article over the weekend where she states that the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, instead of just restricting itself to rescuing people who have genuinely got into trouble as a result of as a result of changes of the weather or the some aspect of their boat failing that couldn't have been foreseen, what they're now doing is that they are spending a lot of their time ferrying people from France over to the UK, and that she has evidence that they've gone within 2 miles of the French coast in order to pick up illegal migrants who are in boats, and instead of then just dropping them the 2 miles back to France, they bring them all the way back to the UK, and so therefore complete their journey for them. And so the Royal National Lifeboat Institution is behaving like a ferry service. And a lot of people give money to the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. I know that lots of people, when they leave part of their estate or some, you know, all of their estate to charity, they very often name the Royal National Lifeboat Institution because they are inspired by stories of these sailors going out in stormy weather where the waves are 30 feet high and they're in their little rescue boats that are specially made so that when they get turned upside down, they turn themselves back up the right way again, and all this sort of thing. And so that the people are portrayed in very heroic terms. And I'm sure that there are rescues that are carried out at sea by the Royal National Lifeboat Institution that do involve a tremendous amount of heroism, and the people that man these boats should be admired for the courage that they show in doing that. But ferrying immigrants across the channel who have deliberately set off in a boat that is inadequate, who set off in warm weather and who are doing it deliberately in order to criminally enter Britain illegally, then I think that is something which is entirely different, and it's not the sort of thing that the sort of people that donate to the Royal Lifeboat Institution would want to donate money to. And I think that if it becomes widely known that the Royal National Lifeboat Institution is deliberately ferrying migrants across the channel, then that could very severely hit the donations that the public make to them. And so they need to be very careful about what they're doing there.
Well, that actually comes on top of them getting caught out putting the money towards burkinis and swimming lessons for children in Bangladesh. I can recall us doing a new story on that one a year or so back. It seems the RNLI has gone woke, hasn't it? I think, didn't they sack some people for making lewd jokes, or the mugs of tea that they had, the pictures that were on their mugs of tea? I mean, these guys, they're seamen that go out there voluntarily risking their lives in all this terrible weather to rescue people, and they're being told that they've got to go out and pick up these illegal immigrants and ferry them over to Britain. I'm sure it isn't the actual seamen that are responsible for this. It will be these politically correct appointees that have been put in place to run the RNLI that are responsible, rather than the fishermen that risk their lives and do it all voluntarily. It would be somebody that's actually paid that is deciding to do that. Do you want to get into this Batley and Spen election, Max, before we get into Greatest Britain's?
Okay, let's talk about that. Yes.
Yes, because we've had this election last week as well, and it did look for a while as if George Galloway might actually win the election. He was challenging it with his Workers' Party. There was somebody called King Leadbeater, who was Joe Cox's sister. She was standing for Labour, and Lawrence Fox was there with Reclaim, his Reclaim party, and Lawrence Fox had a big free speech rally there, which George Galloway was at, and they were drawing attention to the fact that this teacher had been hounded out of his job for showing pictures of Muhammad, which he was supposed to do as part of his classwork. And very noticeably, the Conservatives didn't stand up for him. The education system didn't stand up for him. He now lives in fear of his life. He has to have police protection. He's been told he can go back to the school, but of course he's terrified to go back to the school because he knows what happened to Samuel Paty in France, who was beheaded for doing the same thing. So Lawrence Fox and George Galloway, they were trying to draw attention to this fact, and they were trying to push the Conservative Party into backing this teacher and making a statement that yes, they do back free speech, and yes, they do back this teacher. But of course they wouldn't. So what happened was George Galloway's party ended up taking a lot of the votes away from the Labour Party, and the Labour Party only managed to win by 300 votes. And because the Conservative Party refused to stand up for free speech and refused to back this teacher, they ended up losing. And they could have won that. They really could have won that. And they, and as a result of that, it could have been the total devastation of the Labour Party. Keir Starmer would have had to have been asked to have stepped down, but they didn't. They refused to stand up for free speech. Absolute hypocrites. And good on George Galloway for challenging Labour, and good on Lawrence Fox for drawing attention to it and having his free speech rally, I think. And it seems this Joe Cox's sister is pretty similar to Joe Cox, I think. I believe she's a lesbian, but she's a big supporter of Muslims. It's very, very strange bedfellows there, I think. Well, what are your views on the Batley and Spen election, Max?
Quite similar to yours, I suppose, in that I disagree with George Galloway's politics, but I like his style, and I like him as a person, if you could divorce him from his politics. And so I think it was good that he was able to go there. And because I think the one thing that he does do is he presents his views honestly. He is like Dennis Skinner. He is an honest politician who, has got far left political leanings, but doesn't beat about the bush and doesn't double speak. He talks his mind. He's a forthright person and exhibits a lot of the sort of manly characteristics that people find attractive. And I think that the fact that he did so well and in fact got 21% of the vote in a by-election, which is, you know, is pretty good for somebody who has represents such a small party, and in winning that many votes off of the Conservatives and the Labour Party, I think was admirable. An admirable showing for him. And I think it's a great shame that that Joe Cox's sister has come along to try and mirror and mimic what her older sister presumably would have done. I'm not sure which one of them is the oldest, actually, but what is the Christian name of the Ledbetter candidate? I can't remember.
I think it's Kim, but I couldn't be.
Kim. Oh, yes. Okay, Kim Ledbetter then. I think it's a shame that she is lending her support to the Labour Party and aping the career of her sister, because I think her sister was deluded, and it's very sad that her sister was murdered. But it doesn't sit well to see somebody profiting from the misfortune of their sister in riding to electoral victory on the back of her sister's reputation, really, which I think to some extent is what Kim Ledbetter has done.
Yeah, I like George Galloway. I don't agree with his politics at all, but he does stand up for free speech, and he will stand up for the right for people to say things that other people may not want to hear. I mean, he likes a debate, and I dare say he would make a good MP of a particular area. I mean, he would stand up for everybody in that area and wouldn't show favouritism. He does stick to his leftist principles, and I do think he's an honest man. So yeah, I would have liked to have seen George Galloway win that. I really, really would have done. Well, should we get into our greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Robert Blatchford again with his amazing moustache. Last week we got into some quotes from Merry England, and we were looking at the factory system and how it had ruined the countryside. And this week we're going to take a look at how we could be using that land for farming instead. And we're quoting from page 28 here from his book. And he says, "We come now to the third objection to the factory system, that it is unnecessary. It is often asserted that this country could not feed all her present population. I will try to show you that this is absurd. We have to prove that the British Islands can grow wheat enough to feed 36 million people. In Hoyle's Sources of Wealth, it is stated that Great Britain and Ireland contain about 50 million acres of good land, unbuilt upon and available for agriculture. And Lord Lauderdale estimates that 500 acres will feed 2,000 people. That is 4 to the acre. Therefore, if we used all our available land, we could feed 200 million people. So that's about three times as much people as we actually have in Britain today. We could feed them with these acres of good land. Now I'm a bit concerned that did they mean forestry here? Was this just all open land that could be used for this, Max? What do you think of this? Is this a viable idea that he has here?
Well, when I first heard this idea, I was fascinated by it to a certain extent, and I decided just to investigate whether it was true. And one of the things that I have discovered since becoming vegetarian, basically, is that you can live on potatoes. And I think I've said that before. You can live entirely on potatoes, and the yield in good arable land of potatoes is such that yes, it would be possible to feed 200 million people in the British Isles if we all ate potatoes. I didn't repeat the exercise with regard to other foodstuffs because I just really wanted to prove whether or not it was possible to sustain 200 million people from the acreage of arable land available to farmers both in this country and in Ireland. And we've got to bear in mind that includes Southern Ireland as well. So in view of the fact that ERA has detached itself and is now part of the European Union, there's a fair bit of arable land there that would have been available to us in the early 1900s, which is no longer available to certainly the British government. But that won't necessarily always be the case, because it's my dream that the people of Southern Ireland will one day rejoin the British Isles, their sort of sister nations on the British Isles, and that we will have the four nations of the British Isles reunited under a common leadership. But that's something for the future. But certainly it would be possible to feed 200 million people. And the fact of the matter is that we, instead of feeding ourselves in that way, what we've done is we've just invested a lot of our time in concreting over a lot of the arable land that perhaps would have existed in 1900 to produce factories in order to try and become the workshop of the world. And so I doubt that we could feed 200 million people from the arable land that's available to the United Kingdom at the moment, but it probably would be in excess of 100 billion. And so, we still are in a situation where we could achieve autarky. We could achieve a situation where we are able to provide everything that the people of these islands needs from within our own resources.
There's probably a lot of land up in Scotland that could be used. I would also be concerned that maybe land would have been used for housing purposes as well, to house all the excess peoples that have come to Britain, because as we've pointed out before, we're not producing enough people to replace ourselves already, so we shouldn't actually need any new housing. But I think they're using up some of this land for that as well, but there should be enough to amply feed the 70 million people that there are actually here if we just use the land properly. Well, continuing here, agriculture has been neglected because all the mechanical and chemical skill and all the capital and energy of man have been thrown into the struggle for trade profits and manufacturing preeminence. We want a few Faradays, Watts, Stevensons and Cobdens to devote their genius and industry to the great food question. Once let the public interest and the public genius be concentrated upon the agriculture of England, and we shall soon get silenced the croakers who talk about the impossibility of the country feeding her people. Depend upon it, what I have told you is true, and that England can feed her people as she had fed them in times gone by, with never a factory flue to vomit foulness into the air, and never a greedy money grasper to poison her streams with filth, or wither her woods and glades with soot and sulphur. And I do think that today, when they build factories, they do try to beautify the area as well, and have some countryside programs to help the countryside at the same time as putting the factories up. And you do get factories now that are actually being built in the countryside to try and balance things out so they aren't all there in the city. And I think he's makes a good point here about the fact that we need these geniuses. Faraday's, Watts, Stevenson's and Cobden's. It's genius. It's individual genius that spurs us on forwards. It's not committees. It's not groups of people. It's individual geniuses. And you don't get individual geniuses in peoples that have average IQs of under 100. You're just not going to get it. You're not going to get people with a genius IQ of 130, 140, up to, I don't know, 160. You're just not going to get that with the sort of people that we are now importing into our country. So it's good here that he understands that it's just these individuals that we have in our nation, that they're the ones that actually push us forward, and he wants to see their genius devoted to food. And where he's also pointing out here about mechanical and chemical skill, I mean, the chemical skill has been applied to food, and that hasn't been too good. I mean, I don't like the idea of the genetic modification of organisms, and obviously buying organic is much better, and organic provides work for people as well, with the physical work that is involved in producing the food. It is much better for you, but the problem is that it costs more, and people have got to pay more for it. So I guess you've got to weigh both of those things up. But there have been a lot of advances with farm engineering and farm mechanics since this time. I do think they have actually put more thought into this since then, Max. I get the impression that that they've had to, really. There's been a lot of pressure on the government to clean the country up, beautify the country, not have so much pollution in the cities, because they used to have this pea super fog in London, and you used to be able to even see your hand in front of your face. It was so polluted, you know, sort of the way that we sometimes see Hong Kong or some of the places in China. That's what Britain used to be like. So I do think there has been some improvements, but possibly not enough. What are your thoughts on what he says here about agriculture, Max?
Yeah, I think there have been some improvements. The there are regulations now that apply to issues that affect the environment, and I think that air is generally cleaner today than it has been in the past. You know, there's still some focus on the quality of air in large towns and cities, you know, particularly central London. But if you come out to the rural parts of Britain, there's lots of lovely fresh air here. And the Town Planning Acts that prevented the unrestrained building over of arable land did serve a great purpose. And I mentioned, I think last week, the garden cities and things that had been created during the early part of the last century. And so there has been a lot of work done in order to prevent the spoiling of our countryside and to improve the environment generally. And I think that even as far as farming is concerned, there, you know, despite the fact there's been a lot of automation, which has tended to make farms very large, and it's destroyed hedgerows and things of that sort, which people don't like, there has been other forms of automation, particularly in the dairy industry, where there are now milking sheds and things that are not just crude sheds, that are very highly sophisticated places that are very clean, and where cattle are, the nutrients that they receive are exactly what they need in order to maximise output, and they are milked in very sterile and clean and sterile sort of circumstances, and that has improved milk yields and things of that sort. And so I think that, you know, there is some work to be done. There hasn't been a concerted effort to do it, though, in the same way that, you know, as we've seen with coronavirus, there was a tremendous amount of work done that was sponsored by the government, that was done at Oxford University in order to push forward and to find a vaccine. And, if you just think back to other occasions when there has been a vital national necessity that we have a centre of excellence, where people of high intelligence, people who are able to think outside the box, are taken, just purely because of their ability to think outside the box, their ability to innovate. So during the Second World War, we had Bletchley Park, where lots and lots of young people that were very intelligent were sent there with a blank sheet of paper. They could to design ways of cracking the codes, etc., that existed that the Germans used during the Second World War, and where they fed off each other in terms of the ideas that they were looking at in order to make the tremendous advances that they did, and in order to invent the computer. And tremendous benefits have come as a result of the invention of the computer, and then with regard to the sort of the race to produce atomic weapons at the end of the Second World War with the Manhattan Project, so there are occasions when governments do see that the overriding need to make a step change or a step forward, a large step forward in science in one particular area because of a pressing political need has caused governments to create places of that sort. And what we need is a government to do the same thing with regard to agriculture and with regard to the task, not just of producing profits from agriculture, but the task of feeding our population. And not just feeding them entirely on potatoes, but feeding them a varied diet that will make the food interesting and palatable.
Improving their lives and making them more healthy. I mean, you have to give them credit, really, over the last 100 years. You can see by the way that the average height has increased, that the nutrition has got better, and people weren't living to the fullness of their phenotype before. And that's why the houses were shorter and the door frames were smaller, because people's nutrition wasn't so good. So that has improved. And I think Britain is fairly proud of the way that we treat our animals. You know, we do have very strict rules that have to be kept to. We do still have factory farming, but it's things like chickens that only have tiny little brains. You wouldn't see cattle being treated in that way, for instance. Well, we will next proceed to consider my fourth objection to the factory system, when I think I shall be able to show you beyond all question that besides being hideous, unpleasant, unhealthy, and unnecessary, the factories are a serious danger to the existence of the empire. Why do we weave cloth and cotton? For two purposes. One, to clothe ourselves, and two, to exchange for foreign produce. To provide for our own needs, we must make cotton or linen fabrics, true, but we need not make them by steam power. We could make them by water power and so abolish the smoke nuisance. Will you have the goodness, Mr. Smith, to cast your eyes over the following statements made a few years ago by a Professor Thompson? The average rise and fall of the tide at the city of Bristol, 5 miles from its mouth, is 23 feet. According to calculations I have made from the average volume of water displaced up and down each tide, there are no fewer than 20 billions of foot-pounds of energy wasted each year, or enough to charge 10 million Faro cells. At the mouth of the river, the total annual energy thus running to utter waste cannot be less than 60 billion foot-pounds, and in the rapid currents of the River Severn, with their enormous tides of great volume, the tidal energy must be practically unlimited. A tenth part of the tidal energy in the gorge of the Avon would light the city of Bristol. A tenth part of the tidal energy in the channel of the Severn would light every city. And another tenth part would turn every loom and spindle and axle in Great Britain. The power of water is tremendous. The beauty of water is sublime. Perhaps when our practical men learn a little common sense, we shall be able to grind an axe or throw a shuttle without blackening the sky above or choking the unhappy creatures who crawl upon the earth beneath. Besides, the less coal needed, the fewer colliers needed, and in the Clarion, Tito has told us that 90,000 men and boys are killed and injured every year in the mines. So he's basically advocating the use of natural resources here, much cleaner natural resources. And it seems to me an extension of the water wheel that used to be used for turning the mills, but obviously extended from that. And we do see them trying to make use of this now. But I'm amazed that this could have been done 100 years ago, because they have tried doing this in a part of Wales and they actually gave up doing it. I'm not quite sure why. What do you know about this tidal energy that can be used here, Max?
I have to say, I don't know a tremendous amount about it. It all sounds highly plausible. I know that the Severn Bore, as it's called, is highly regarded as being a source of natural energy that's not properly been exploited so far, and that has existed, as we now understand, all the way back to the times of Blatchford and before. So I certainly think it's something that can be explored. And I think there are lots of ways in which we can exploit natural energy, the wind and the tides. I think that a lot of people, when they see these large windmills nowadays, they sort of decry the fact that they look hideous and they spoil the countryside. I don't think that's I don't find them that hideous. I find the windmills actually quite attractive shapes. They are naturally shaped in order to catch the wind as optimally as possible, and anything that's shaped by nature tends to be an attractive design, and I think that the wind power farms and things that have been set up off the coast of England will be able to produce a tremendous amount of electricity, and can certainly help us in terms of cleaning up the planet and certainly cleaning up Britain. The only downside, I think, to having such a great reliance on natural power sources is that it makes the country more vulnerable to attack, because I think it would be very difficult to defend the windmills and the wind farms that exist off the coast of England. And so that's something that people perhaps need to think about. But other than that, I think that there is tremendous scope, and it is just a shame that people who were forward looking, like Blatchford, who were thinking about these things over 100 years ago, that they weren't listened to by more people, because we could have been in a much better situation now than we are, had Blatchford become a prime minister, for example.
It amazes me that all the environmental side of things has been hijacked by the left, because it's a nationalist occupation, isn't it? I mean, it's blood and soil. It's the soil that we're interested in, and it's the environment and preserving the environment, not just preserving our race and preserving our people and our culture, but preserving the landscape that we have shaped over thousands of years, and not harming it. And I may not agree with you with the windmills. I don't like to see the windmills, because I like to see a beautiful natural landscape that doesn't look like that there's any industry there. And then you see these windmills on top of the hills, and it's like it's the government intruding on your space when you're trying to get away from them. I think maybe tidal power would be a better idea. It would be less intrusive. I should imagine that most of it would actually be under the water. It wouldn't have to be on top of it.
If you go somewhere where there are wooden windmills that date back 200 years or so, people always go, "Oh, look at that lovely windmill." It's the fact that it's 200 years old that sort of dampens people's sort of reaction to it. And if people thought the same way of a modern shaped windmill, then it could have exactly the same effect. People could say, "Oh, look at all these lovely windmills generating electricity very cleanly, and they're not really intruding that much on our enjoyment of the rest of the land." They might be featuring photographs where we might have liked it otherwise for them not to be there, but we wouldn't have objected had there been a whole row of old wooden windmills. So why object because they are taller and steel windmills?
Well, because they don't look so natural. And you think of the windmill, it's got a natural shape to it. It looks almost like a part of the body, almost like a sort of phallic shape there. And the wing, actual wings of the windmill, they look rather like feathers with winged, feathered wings. And when you look at the windmills, it just looks synthetic, and it doesn't look as if it's a natural part of the landscape. But the but the windmills do. I mean, even the smaller ones, they look like the old dovecots or like beehives, the old style of beehive, and they do have a much more natural feel to them. But they're probably not as economic, probably not as good at producing the power. But as I say, I think tidal power, from what he's saying there, I mean, that is a phenomenal amount of power that could yes. that could be harnessed. Absolutely phenomenal. And it would be under the water. It is baffling to me how the left have managed to take this over, because it is such a nationalist preoccupation with the environment. Well, he continues. Now, Mr. Smith, why should we make cotton goods for foreign countries? The Manchester School will tell you that we must do it to buy corn. In 1885, we exported cotton goods to the value of £66 million, and we imported corn and flour in the same year to the value of £53 million. Why? The Manchester School will tell you that we cannot grow our own corn, and that is not true. They will tell you that as foreigners can grow corn more cheaply than we can, and as we can make cotton goods more cheaply than they can, it is to the interest of both parties to exchange. I do not believe that any nation can sell corn more cheaply than we could produce it, and I am sure that even if it cost a little more to grow our corn than to buy it, yet it would be to our interest to grow it. I know it has been said, and it is said, that an English farmer owning his land cannot compete with foreign dealers, but I think that is doubtful, and I am sure that if the land were owned by the state and farmed systematically by the best methods, we might grow our corn more cheaply than we could buy it. Now, I'll just stop there, because you have a sense of self-sufficiency when you're growing your own corn. You can take pride in the fact that you're producing this for yourself, and the people are out there in the fields and in the beautiful countryside, rather than being in the factory and working in the factory. It's going to be much better to be out in the environment, breathing in the fresh air. I mean, people who actually live in the fresh air and live in the country, they live for much longer than the people that live in the cities. And part of that has got to be because they're surrounded by beauty all the time. And he made this point earlier in the book as well, talking about the need to have beauty around you. So it's not just the fact that that they would be producing their own corn, but that it would also be conducive to them being outside, being in the fresh air, getting their hands into the soil, and just being surrounded by the beauty of the countryside. Do you think, Max?
Well, Blatchford, I think, was quite right in the statement he made that British corn growers could grow corn just as effectively and just as economically as foreign corn growers. But he was talking at that time about competition between British farmers and perhaps French farmers or German farmers or Italian farmers. So he was talking about competition with farmers that lived in societies where there was a similar standard of living, and so in that respect, it certainly was the case that a British farmer could produce corn just as efficiently as another competitor European country could produce corn. But what he wasn't thinking about was the corn imported from faraway places where there was an entirely different level of mechanism, or where there was an entirely different level of standard of living in that country, because as far as the cotton trade is concerned, the cotton trade was lost to Britain because cotton could be produced more cheaply in India, largely because the Indian workers were prepared to work for only a fraction of what the British workers were prepared to work for. And so therefore, our cotton industry was then exported to India. And there were companies whose objective was, over the last 100 years or so, to dismantle and take the machines that had been used to produce cotton in the cotton mills of Britain and take them over to India and reassemble them in factories in India, where the cheaper labour could produce the cotton more cheaply than it could be produced here in Britain. So that's why the cotton industry was destroyed in the north of England. Same thing goes for leather goods. There are certain towns in England and Britain as a whole that were famous for producing leather goods. Northampton, a town that I used to live in, was famous for producing shoes. But I encountered people who were running companies that specialised in the dismantling and transporting of shoe manufacturing machinery from Northampton over to India. And they did nothing but that. That was their entire raison d'etre. They were dismantling an industry, transporting it and reassembling it somewhere else where people were prepared to work for less and could therefore produce shoes more cheaply than they were being produced in this country. I'm sure it didn't only happen in Britain. I'm sure it happened in Germany and France and other European countries, that they lost their industries to third world countries during the last 100 years or so. And so as far as Robert Blatchford is concerned, he wasn't quite right in the sense that the British farmer could stand up to competition from anywhere else in the world. But what he was right about was that we could stand up to competition from other European countries. And this is probably the main principle that provides the idea of the European Union, with some justification that the European Union tried to create a kind of closed economy where a priority would be given to goods produced within the European Union, albeit that the European Union suffered other mortal failings. But the point is that in this country, had we governments that had that would have supported the cotton industry and that would have applied taxes on cotton, cheaper cotton coming from India, for example, then the transportation and the loss of our cotton industry would have been stopped. The transportation and the loss of our leather goods industry would have been stopped. The woolen industry would have been saved, and there would still be lots of industry in the north of England providing jobs for lots of people that would have been cleaner and more productive, and that would have provided them with steady careers and a living throughout their lifetimes.
Yeah, who could have seen where free trade was going to end up? I mean, the same thing's happened in America, really, with all the industry being hived off to China and entire factories being boxed up and sent off to China. But continuing here, Blatchford says, well, suppose we could not. The logical result of the free trade argument would be that British agriculture must perish. And what do we lose? We lose the beauty and the health of our factory towns. We lose annually some 20,000 lives in Lancashire alone. We are in constant danger of great strikes like that which recently so crushed our cotton operatives. We are reduced to the meanest shifts and the most violent acts of piracy and slaughter to open up markets for our goods. We lose the stamina of our people and we lose our agriculture. Did you ever consider what it involves, this ruin of British agriculture? That's interesting, the way that he links all those things together, and also shows this awareness of the piracy and the slaughter, the bad side of the British Empire, and how that was intended to open up these markets over there. I'm not so certain that the rest of the country were aware of that. What do you think of what he has to say here, Max?
I think he's quite right there. I mean, that the British Empire was, I believe, beneficial to the vast majority of people who became subject to it. But as with all things, it didn't come without a cost. And part of the cost and part of the downside of having the British Empire was the fact that there was a certain amount of conflict between ourselves and other countries, where we were trying to, where plutocrats within our society, people who were globalist in their economic aims and who were able to shift money from country to country and who were aiming to benefit from having the cheapest labour, were able to use our navy and our army in order to subdue competitors and in order to provide them with riches at the expense of the lives of the rest of our people.
And we lost a lot of our agriculture anyway. We probably have less people that are dying now. I mean, you said some 20,000 lives in Lancashire alone that end up being lost. Was that in industrial accidents through illness, or what is he referring to there? I mean, that seems an awful lot of people's lives to lose annually, or is that just early death? What is he referring to there? Do you know?
I think a lot of early industry was quite dangerous, and you could quite easily, if you weren't didn't have your wits about you and you were operating a machine in a factory, you could quite easily lose a finger or lose your hand if you didn't sort of pull it back fast enough as the some kind of a shuttle or something was zinging past you. And there were lots of machines that operated without adequate guards in early times, and so people tended to get injured on those. And because the machinery, because the factories were, you know, quite dirty places to work, and I think I mentioned to you last week about how you know, just nicking your finger working in some of the dirty factories that existed in Britain over the last 100 years or so could end up produce a really severe infection for you if you weren't careful. There was a higher mortality rate, and it's the mortality rate in this country has been improved as a result of there being better medical facilities, as a result of people eating a more balanced diet, and as a result of the National Health Service providing people with medical care that that previous generations didn't have. A lot of the improvements have also come as a result of the introduction of safety at work practices and things of this sort, where organisations have gone round to make sure that factories do have the guardrails and things fitted to their machines so that people can't fall in or catch themselves in. You still hear occasionally, and it was perhaps more common in the past, where women particularly who didn't have their hair tied up in a bun, if they had long hair and it perhaps hung down to their waist, as it does if you let it grow naturally, lots of women that worked in industry would catch their hair in a machine and then be dragged into the machine by their hair and have their scalp ripped off in order to save their lives, and who were then sort of grossly disfigured, but would then very often get an infection as a result of the gaping wound on the top of their head, etc. And so factories were dangerous places to work, and particularly the cotton jennies, I think they were called, the machinery that was used to weave cotton and to weave other fabrics. The children used to be employed to scrabble around on the floor underneath the machinery, picking up bits that fell off, and sometimes rejoining pieces of thread that had snapped whilst the machines were still working very often. And the children in those circumstances, you know, quite often used to use loose fingers and hands.
Makes you really pleased that you're alive today, really. I mean, we complain about conditions today, but they were far worse 100 years ago, and it completely destroys this myth of white privilege. I mean, that was how most people had to live. You know, they had to work 12, 16 hours a day just to bring home a pittance. They didn't have the spare time that we have now. And these are all the things that Blatchford was campaigning to put a stop to and to improve. And next week, we'll get into his ideas about autarky. I think we should leave that there, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.